Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Wow, it's a natural pause. That's fantastic. Well, hello, everyone. A very warm welcome to this event, The Power of Storytelling and Activism. And it's taking place on the eve of the summer solstice, so anything could happen. It's great to see so many of you here today and also online. And we have in this part of the room, you may well be already able to feel it, we have the air of global celebrity. Sadly not coming from me, but coming from our wonderful guests that have joined us today. So we have with us Yasmin Abdel Majid, no less, Sudanese author, screenwriter, award-winning social advocate, loved by millions of young readers for her teen fiction, and now adored by, shall we say, not-so-young readers for her debut adult fiction book, At Sea. This is your seventh book, for goodness sake. So a very warm welcome to Yasmin. Also, Amir Nizar Zuabi, founding artistic director of Sheba Hua Theatre Company in Palestine, and an award-winning playwright and director and artistic director of Warp Productions, leading The Herds and Little Amal. So it's an absolute pleasure to have you both here today. My name is Joanna Lewis. I'm a professor here at LSE in Imperial History and also director of the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. So why a session very quickly then on storytelling and activism? You've been at the festival, you've been so good, I'm sure. You've had all the data, all the facts, all the clever arguments, all the theories, the predictions, more data. But is that part of the problem with what to do next? Can it be overwhelming? Can it feel existential, alienating? And is this part of something that actually now we need to push back on to engage with? We've got these juggernauts of historical change hurtling towards us, juggernauts of hate as well, if you try and do something about it sometimes on social media. We are exposed to epicenters of human suffering around the world. And many people talk of desensitization as a result of all this material, that normal feeling is moving away from them. They are finding harder and harder to be human. We've got social media and the dead world of AI. There are so many chatbots out there now that the internet is actually more dead than alive. So how do we engage? And in the words of the most underrated social commentator who I think sums up this disengagement, Shania Twain, that don't impress me much. How do we get empathy, emotion, empowerment? How do we get people to make meaningful, to become meaningful change makers, to get off their screens, to get off their sofas, out of their pyjamas? Maybe I'm talking about myself more here. But how do we find then pathways that can lead to that rehumanization, that healing, that justice, to find community and compassion? And as the African proverb says, if the lion doesn't learn to tell the story, then the tale will always glorify the hunter. And I certainly believe that there is far more truth in fiction and far more honesty usually in the art of human performance. So that's why I'm so delighted to have our guests with us today. So the format is fairly standard, as you can imagine. Yasmin and Amir Nizar are going to reflect on the theme of storytelling as it relates to their practice and to reflect on where we can take it from the perspective of 2026. And then we can open up for discussion in the audience. We've only got an hour, which seems so cruel. So Yasmin, if I could turn to you first, and I'm going to come and sit in the middle, if I may. Try not to fall over anything. Yasmin, backstory, first of all, before we get to the story. You have the most extraordinary, brilliant, dramatic backstory. Born in Khartoum, Then it grew up in Australia. Now you live in London. And I've taken out just a few things because I could actually talk about your life for the rest of the hour. You got a first-class degree in mechanical engineering. And then the phrase getting Yasmined went viral because of the online abuse you experienced when you spoke up for headscarves and also for Sharia. But you've also written, she's also written for Emmerdale, which is one of the longest running UK soaps set in the Yorkshire Dales.
The plot twist nobody saw coming.
So then, when did it start? When did storytelling start and what does it mean to you?
Well, thank you so much for the question. Thank you all for coming out on a Sunday afternoon. It's lovely to see you all here, and I'm really excited to be in conversation with the Amir Nizar. Amir in Arabic means prince, so I've just been calling him the Amir Nizar to kind of... you are obligated to say that, but I will call you the Amir for the rest of this time. I think as a Sudanese person, stories... and like the kind of the culture of oral storytelling has always been part of my life, part of how I've understood the world. I think as someone who is Muslim and brought up Muslim and kind of engaged in what it means to have faith, I think stories are a big part of that as well. Like the ways in which you learn about faith growing up is often through stories, whether it's about stories of prophets or about the stories in the Quran. So I think when you ask the question, where does it start? I can't even pinpoint a moment where stories weren't part of my life, right? And I'm a believer in this idea that stories create meaning, like they help us understand the world. And often when I'm asked about the kind of organizing that I've done or the advocacy and so on that I've been part of throughout my life, I'll always pick a couple of stories. And I'm curious, maybe you might have this in your lives. Where I heard a story about a particular person, or I read a particular thing, or I watched a particular film, and that changed the way that I saw the world. It transformed the way that I understood, understood how the world worked, or even understood like my ability to change the world. I mean, when I was probably about 13 years old, I read a book that was very, very important to me, and it, unfortunately, it wasn't the Quran, but it was a different one called Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Again, like, I'm not sure how many people have read, she's had a new life on Netflix. But Sabrina was this young girl who, was a witch, but always kind of got spells wrong, right? And there was one particular afternoon where she was like, nobody listens to me, nobody pays attention to me, I bet you I could disappear and it wouldn't make a difference. So she cast a spell and she erased herself from existence. But she could see what life was like if she wasn't there, right? So she saw that all of a sudden her best friend had started dating this like awful guy because she wasn't there to be like, babes, he's trouble, don't do it. Her aunties had stopped talking to each other and moved out because she wasn't there to like kind of make the peace between them. Her actual boyfriend had like ended up in prison because she wasn't there to be his moral compass. So like there were all of these things that even though she was just this young girl who didn't realize or who didn't think her life had any sort of impact, this allowed her to kind of see that actually she was changing the lives of the people around her. And I read this as a 13-year-old and I was like, oh my God, like how different would the world be if I erased myself from existence? So I ran away for an afternoon. That didn't make much of a difference. But that for me was kind of one of those turning points, and kind of going back to this idea of stories, people could have said to me, Yasmin, your life matters, it makes a difference, and so on, but the kind of reading of a story and a tale that I connected to shifted something in me and kind of became a foundational text for then how I like moved through life.
I'm sure a lot of people now are thinking about the equivalent that they read. I think what's going to be for a generation a foundational text is actually your latest novel. It's been out for a couple of weeks. This is At Sea. So I'd just like to fast forward to this and to bring Zainab, the heroine, on centre stage. She'll be relatable, I think, to a lot of women, and thank you so much for the story. I mean, for so many stories. But the story when she has her period suddenly, she has nothing, and so she has to, use whatever's to hand. So how many of us have had to give a professional public performance with half a roll of toilet paper down the trousers? Thank you for that. You deserve a prize. But tell us, I mean, she's the heart and soul of this story. So tell us about her. What do you feel that she is conveying in relation to perhaps some of the things that we're addressing in the festival? What as a vehicle, as a literary device, though it seems unfair to call her that because she seems quite real to me now, having read it twice. Yeah. What is she doing?
So for those who don't know, Zainab is the protagonist of the novel At Sea. And the kind of setup is she's a driller on oil rigs. She's a Sudanese woman who's a driller on oil rigs. And her boss comes to her when she's at home with her pregnant sister. And he's like, I've got that promotion you've always wanted. You get to run the rig. But there's a catch. Something really bad's about to happen. And you have to just deal with it, you know, before things hit the fan. So we kind of follow Zainab over the course of 3 days as she tries to figure out what to do and tries to convince the men to listen to her in time. So, you know, this novel is like, when I've talked about it, I've often said, you know, yes, it's about being an outsider in this closed world, being a woman in a male-dominated industry, but it's also about, like, how do you hold on to truth when nobody around you believes you? And actually, like, you know, it's funny, when I was trying to sell this book, I had some agents say to me, like, I think it's quite unethical to write a book about an oil rig in the time of the climate crisis. And I was like, I hear you. I'm personally not responsible for it. But also, what I'm trying to do with this book is kind of use the setting of this particular, like, of this world to, as a metaphor almost for the kinds of, for that actual behavior, for this kind of sense that you know what is true. Everyone can see the signs, the data is in front of you, and Zainab is constantly in this position where she's like, look at the look at the number, look at the whatever. And for various reasons, the people in power around her, and even though she is one person in a position of like relative power, she's unable to convince. And all of the technical things that happen in the book are based off the Deepwater Horizon explosion that happened in the Gulf of Mexico about 15, 16 years ago now. So it's actually kind of wild. Like there were some parts, there's a couple of lines that I took from an email an engineer actually wrote to some of the people on the rig. And, you know, when we were editing it, that, you know, editors were like, this can't possibly be real. Like it can't possibly be this blatant that they were like, don't worry about it, it'll all be fine. But I didn't make it up. Like some of the lines are actually taken from the emails that these engineers wrote. So I kind of wanted to do that because like you don't want to believe, and sometimes you're kind of like, I don't want to believe that it's as blatant or as kind of obvious or as whatever, but it is. And why did I decide to do this in fiction rather than write an essay or write a sort of nonfiction book about it? I think we've tried to come at this so many different ways. I was like, perhaps if I can put people in the feeling of that, maybe it will shift something in them. If I can, because it's a in some ways it's a frustrating read, but you also want her to succeed. You know what the outcome's gonna be, but you also kind of want her to you know, make good. You want it to, I'm not gonna ruin the ending, but you kind of know what happened. So I think maybe I think that was kind of my attempt is like, let me put you let me put you on that rig. And if you had all of that information.
I was on that rig for 2 days.
and would you be able, like, yeah, I think this is, a question. And hopefully it produces that emotional shift. We'll see, yeah.
I definitely think it will. I really encourage you to read it. It's called At Sea. And it has a devastating critique of men in it as well. I thought I was pretty good at how I could write about in this. But, yeah. Okay. To be continued, because I want now to turn to Amir Nizar. And I want to remind people that you are an award-winning playwright and director. You were born, I've got to get this right, in Jerusalem, but you grew up in Nazareth.
Both in Jerusalem
and Nazareth. And that's where you set up the Shibahir Theatre Company in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And you are a founding artistic director and associate, which you were founding director of, and also associate director, being of the Young Vic Theatre. So again, your writing and your achievements are so expansive. They include Ayn Yusuf, This is my brother, Samson and Delilah, When the World Was Green. And you've also done the Royal Shakespeare Company Comedy of Errors. But you're probably most known, especially amongst this generation, for The Herds and for Little Amal. And this, ladies and gentlemen, won Time Out number one arts event of 2022. And you've also been stage director of Together for Palestine, which was an amazing event in Wembley Arena that raised £1.5 million. So we've got a little film clip here to remind people, if you haven't seen this, of this extraordinary artistic performance intervention. Extraordinary. They are so realistic. It's just absolutely amazing. I'd love to begin again, as with Yasmin, of asking you about your journey of artistic expression and activism from Jerusalem.
I don't speak without my agent. Hello, you.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it's so realistic, those eyes. You don't actually see people, you see the animal and all that that represents.
Yeah, puppetry is amazing. They were incredible, right?
Yeah.
Puppetry is amazing. I didn't care much about puppetry when I started doing theater. I grew up in Palestine, and for many years that was the center of where I created work. I was lucky enough to do some shows that traveled internationally, and I was invited to become an associate of the Young Vic, which was a huge learning curve and a huge opportunity, because suddenly I was both in Palestine but also able to create internationally. And very much what Yasmina said was very, very real for me, because I grew up in a culture that idolizes stories. Palestine is a very, very ancient land with all the troubles of the world gathered in it. My family owned lands on Mount Precipice, which, if you know your Bible, and if you don't, you don't. But if you do, Jesus, as a teenager, is preaching to the elder Jews of Nazareth in the synagogue and convincing them that the laws of Sabbath, the way they observe the Sabbath, is wrong. And that's very cheeky, because he's a teenager and they're elders. And they grab him and drag him to this mountain, which is a real precipice. And they're about to throw him off the cliff when the angels carry him to Mount Tabor. That's not anti-Semitic, that's in the book. And actually, the first theater production I did was age 14, which was to recreate that moment, because I discovered that if you jump in a very particular angle, you will land on a ledge, and the ledge has a cave. I'm not saying that Jesus did that. I'm sure he was carried by the angels. And I invited all my friends, and I thought of it as a theater production. I rehearsed. I was the director, not the writer.
You had the OG, huh?
The OG did it, but I directed it carefully. I was the stuntman. I was the lead actor. And I invited all my friends up to the mountain, and I jumped. And I hid in the cave, and there was a way to sneak from behind and to appear. And that moment of reappearing was incredible, because my friends saw me disappear. They were panicked, a bit like Sabrina the Witch. And a minute later, I appeared, and that ability to manipulate reality became an obsession. And I think that's the moment I became a theater maker. I read a lot as a child. I loved reading. I loved reading Shakespeare. So when I got to direct in the RSC and I did Comedy of Errors, I did it like I read it, with all the ignorance of not knowing how to do it the right way, which made it fun and weird and wild. But before that, and I think this is important for this panel. I started directing by chance. I was about to start my first investigation as a very young director when the second Intifada broke. And I was working in Ramallah and the tanks were rolling and the theater was closed. And all the actors that were supposed to do Kobe Abe, who's an incredible Japanese playwright. And I was trying to gather these actors, professional actors. The man that used to run the theater, a small theater in Ramallah, got so bored of me begging. He went, okay, I'll give you a week in a rehearsal room with some of the actors to investigate this Kobe Abe play. That I translated into Arabic from English. And as we were preparing to do that, the Intifada started, the theater was closed, the actors scattered to the wind, and I was devastated because suddenly I was a young man in the middle of a war, and I had no precipice to throw myself off and come back miraculously. And the first opportunity I had after months of begging disappeared as well. So both as an artist and as a human being, I was devastated. So I basically slash threatened slash begged again that we reopened the theater, and we did. I had a very stern argument with the artistic director, Georges Ibrahim, the magnificent. And I went, I'll crowbar the doors if you don't open it. So you better open it. And he did. And I managed to gather all the actors, and for a span of a week, 2 weeks, we created something. It wasn't theater. It was us mourning together. It was us spending time trying to investigate this new reality we were flung into. And then we performed it. And the theater never felt so important. And never felt so full. People came because we needed to spend time together. And that was probably the most important thing artistically I've done. Because that really showed me the power of us being together. Not the storyteller telling. I'm not as talented as Yasmina to write really good novels. But the ability to get together into community and share a story together. And I think that was the foundation of what then becomes my theater practice. And with progression became Little Amal and The Herds and the next projects we were planning.
I think that is a lovely lead then into talking about Little Amal, because that emotion that we saw that with the gorilla, just in those gestures in that face, that ability to convey emotion, which is so crucial, and we see that in Little Amal. So could you tell us a little bit more about her and the idea behind her and the effect that she has had?
So Little Amal started by the magnificent David Lan, who used to run the Young Vic for many years, and I had the pleasure of meeting age 23 when he invited one of my shows over, and ever since he became a very, very foundational character in my life. And he had this idea of creating a walk honoring the refugee experience that was happening across Europe. Of course, refugees walking from Syria, but from Iran, from Afghanistan, from elsewhere, from Sudan, crossing Turkey, crossing the Aegean Sea. And he went, we will walk, a group of artists will do this walk. And together with the brilliant Stephen Daldry, that told him blank zero what I didn't dare to say, which is that's a really bad idea. Stephen went, how does this become theater? And in a matter of a couple of meetings, we came up with the idea that we need to take somebody. We need to be the guardians of someone. And that's how Little Amal was born. We approached Handspring Theater Company, the creators of War Horse, and some of the best, the Rolls Royce of puppet companies. And they created this incredible girl. And then we had a problem. What do you do with it? Because it was great that we have her, and we had this vague idea of walking her across two continents. And there I remembered the ABC of theatre for me, which is community, which is creating a place of real meeting. And we created this very, very elaborate first journey that started in the border of Khilis and Gaziantep in Syria, where a lot of the Syrian refugees came through Aleppo into Turkey, Turkiye, and then walk all through Turkey, all through Europe, and eventually arrive to Manchester. And we literally built the journey as 67 cities in this first journey. And in each city, she would do 3 days, 5 days, 1 day, where she was alive, which meant that she was alive continuously. Mm-hmm. And we tried to keep that. And basically, I invited a lot of amazing, amazing artists and theater groups around Turkey and Europe to harbor a frightened little girl for a day or for an hour. The invitation was, I'm gonna bring a girl, can you bring cake? That was the, and what is the cake you bring? And what that brought out of my collaborators, my co-authors, was an incredible amount of generosity and creativity and ingenuity. So but actually, hundreds of participants, hundreds of people, hundreds of amazing artists created Amal by telling her story as a big community. Mm. And in many ways, that was another moment of eye-opening, because I understood how I accumulate a story like a novel. You know, theater is very restricted. It's a breath. It's one intake of air, if you do it right, right? Let's say you put, and it's a roller coaster, and at the end you're somewhere else, and you walk into the night out of the theater, and you're transposed, but it's an intake of air. And suddenly I had the ability to tell a story over 3 months, over 30,000 kilometers, or some ridiculous number, which is the distance between Gaziantep, to tell the story with hundreds of co-authors, and to, yes, accumulate a very accurate story that suddenly, I remember the moment, it suddenly tipped. Suddenly, from a bunch of weirdos walking around with a giant puppet, we got to cities where we had thousands of people waiting for Amal. She became a symbol. She became a symbol of hope, a symbol of people connecting. And she became every one of the people she met, which was the beauty, because I had people telling me that they are Amal. Sometimes in Marseille, we were walking along the port, and a Syrian lady came whispering to her, saying, "Allah yahfazik binti." And you know exactly what it says. Means, "My daughter, God protect you." And the agony in her eyes meant she's talking to her real lost daughter. Mm-hmm. So I stopped and I went and I spent a moment with her, and she made me promise that I make sure that Amal is safe. So Amal became the sublimation of her grief. In New York, an old Jewish lady said, "I was a child in the Holocaust. I am Amal." And in Mexico, Mexican refugees or Guatemalan refugees said, "I am Amal." And I think that's the beauty of this. She becomes a vessel. And in many ways, that's the beauty of puppetry. Which I didn't care for, but I fell in love in, because it's a half-full, half-empty vessel, which means any one of you became a gorilla for a moment. Each one of you could breathe with her for a second, which means there's a dialogue.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
And then the last bit, and I know I'm talking too much, but no, I'm awake since 4 in the morning, so I'm very tired and I'll yabber for hours.
Don't think they mind.
Yeah. And the last bit of this that for me is incredible was the streets. I kind of the ability to leave this hierarchy where I'm talking and you're politely listening to a place where you can leave if I'm boring, and thank God you can't. But that the lack of hierarchy that the streets gives is incredible and reminded me of me growing up in Palestine. Reminded me of a different formation of community, which in European theater structures doesn't exist anymore. You come, you pay a lot of money to see a show, usually dragged by somebody. And there's a very clear hierarchy of that experience. And I wanted to get rid of that hierarchy and see what happens when we meet like citizens, like equals, which is the last bit of this equation for me, which is the city square, the domus, this old, unfashionable world democracy that I don't believe in anymore after Palestine. Like I don't believe in human rights, and I don't believe all of these big words white people say that don't apply to me or to my people. But nevertheless, I want to cling on to us as a group, as a group of individuals that become community for a second, not the political structures. And that's what I try to create in the herds, in Amal, in our next project, which is a very, very long marathon-like crawl through city centers with people crawling on all fours. And I see some of my collaborators, my young friends that worked with me on that. And I'm working with Brian Eno and with the magnificent choreographer Gregory McComa to create that piece that will happen next year. And that's my reaction to what's happening back home as well.
Thank you so, so much for that. And I would encourage people to watch the film, because you see a 3.5-meter puppet being embraced by people. She's lying on the floor and you see women coming up, stroking her cheek, kissing her. And unless you've seen it, it's hard to imagine that. Although having seen the gorilla, I think now we can. But what is also fantastic, as you say, with the story, is that you give her agency as well. So I think it's in Naples, isn't she? She has a tantrum, that's how it's called. She does an act of resistance herself. So, as you say, she has her own life, and she's not this passive sort of, you know, vessel.
For me, it was really important that the 10-year-old refugee, vulnerable child, the victim, is actually what you're looking up to, which is why she became so big. She is a goddess, and goddesses are not respectful. She is 10-year-old, and she reacts like a 10-year-old. I have a daughter, she's now 12. She's redhead and fiery and tells me what to do all day. So when I was creating Little Amal, I thought of her as a real 10-year-old, Mediterranean, hot-blooded, a bit like my daughter, and she was a nightmare to walk with, but lots of fun. She would walk away if you were boring. She was disrespectful to authority. Sometimes she was tired and miserable, and sometimes she was really interested and curious, and she always wanted ice cream. And sometimes she got incredibly lonely and very, very sad thinking of her dead parents. And the ability to flip the narrative on people was part of the joy, right? You're in the middle of a big birthday party in the V&A, and suddenly everybody's celebrating, and suddenly you see that she is becoming very solemn and very still and very sad. And people understand that, and people go, I know what she's going through.
Amazing.
And that's part of the trick.
Amazing. Please do watch the films if you haven't seen it. So the last question for me then, before we open it out to the floor, is in 2026, Yasmin, why is storytelling so important now?
Gosh, I mean, I think we have to look further than what Amir Nizad was just talking about. I mean, I think it can feel impossible, I think, the moment, the time we live in. Like, I think of myself as somebody who has always kind of been, not optimistic, but sort of had faith in our agency to do something about the world. And it can feel, I think, you know, people give it lots of different names, the polycrisis, you know, whatever it is, whether it's climate change, whether it's genocide in Gaza, genocide in Sudan, whether it's, you know, multiple things, like, whether it's like 8 white dudes in America owning everything, and I can't even park a car without having to, like, give away my, like, first child's name. Like, it just feels impossible. It feels suffocating. And so I think I'm often like, how do we, what is the way through this? What is the way, you know, and sometimes the way that I find optimism is I'm like, well, I'm sure people felt pretty bad in the Black Plague. Like, you know, I try to find, like, you know, historical
equivalents.
I don't know, maybe they all were like, this is shit. Probably they did. And so, but I mean, for me, storytelling is probably the thing that keeps me alive, frankly. It's the thing that reminds me that I'm not completely disassociated from myself, from the people around me. I think it can be very easy to disassociate and to be like, I just have to stay alive and look after my, like, I think that is a turn that is rewarded, you know, to kind of just stay looking inwards and not worry and not be concerned. So it reminds me that I'm alive. It reminds me that things are actually possible. But also, I think maybe I want to speak to a little bit about what Amir Nizar was talking about, which is this sense of, especially for things like theatre, it can bring us together. And actually nothing can happen if we're not together, whether it is... And the best kind of story is the story that you see yourself in, and the story that is, that feels universal, and the story that all of a sudden kind of connects you to everybody else and reminds you that things are actually possible. And in fact, that sense of things are not possible is what those who would seek to oppress want us to believe in order for nothing to change, right? Every empire falls. I believe there will be an end to whichever empire we find ourselves in. That's not the question. The how and the when is maybe more the question. And I think stories remind us of that. And for me, they're the fuel. They are the fuel that keep me going.
Wonderful answer, thank you. Amir, can I turn to you then? I know you've already partly answered this question, but storytelling, performance, artistry at this particular time, 2026, why is it so important? Can it be effective?
Well, I fluctuate. I must admit that while, and we do these incredibly demanding projects like taking a herd of animals all the way from the Kinshasa forest to the Arctic Circle, trying to kind of give impossible a middle finger. That's basically the attempt, is to go, nothing's impossible. We can think differently when we work together. We can achieve incredible things. And when I was creating that piece, I also met incredible generosity, because in each city we worked with 100 young people that came to train, to learn how to puppeteer these herds. Because in London we had 80 animals, guys, right? Around 80? 80 animals. 80 animals is almost 150 puppeteers. It's a lot of people. And then you go to bed at night and go, does it at all matter? And does it affect anything? And I have to believe that it does, because I believe that we're like water on stone, right? We erode it slowly, slowly. I think story is the way we think. Story is who we are. And unless we insist that the story isn't genocidal rhetoric and hatred, just pure hatred, pure vitriol to anybody that isn't you, unless we don't give an alternative, which is not white dominant patriarchy, that means that the animals that live with us on the planet have space and we need to move out of their way when they're coming in big numbers, or when a frightened 10-year-old comes our way, be it if she's real, if she's from Gaza, if she's from Sudan, if she's from Ukraine, and I can go on and on in this list of human misery. If she's from Inhab in Iran, And the list can go on for hours, unfortunately. I have to think that this matters to give an alternative, a different voice, and not alone. Of course, there's a lot of other much better voices to try and tell a different story, to tell a different story of connectivity, of being together, of believing that we all matter. And I'm fed up with the kind of with the erect victor. He is as boring as a penis. I'm completely fed up with the erect victor that can smash his way through everything. And I think it's the same problem. For me, Israel and climate change is the same problem. It's not two different problems. It's the same mindset that goes, I can smash my way through everything. Through the planet, through the rainforest, through the people, through the children, through the schools, through human rights, through whatever construction, through international law, through what we call decency, which is of course negotiated very elegantly, through Judaism, through Islam, through Christianity, through whatever you want. You can smash your way through it by force. And I go, that's a problem. And the only thing that can stop force is softness. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that can stop a box? A punch. If you do this, this aches and this aches. If you do this, at least it stops. Mm-hmm. It takes a while to stop, but it stops. And then you can start a negotiation. It's a failed attempt right now. It will feel miserable. It feels miserable. I've lost friends in this war, in this genocide. I've got family back home. I've exiled myself from my country. But I think I don't have a choice. I don't know how to say it better. I don't really have a choice. Neither do you.
No.
I think one of the advantages, and then I'll shut up, I swear. I think that one of the advantages...
Said every uncle ever.
I am very uncle.
Like, we love it.
I think one of the advantages of coming from a place like Sudan, or a place like Palestine, or a place like Nigeria, which I've spent some time in recently, or Kinshasa, or many other places, is that we have already collapsed and stood up multiple times. For us, the end, yeah, the kind of the polycrisis, we have been in polycrisis for 73 years. We have developed the resilience and the flexibility, the softness, to find a way back up. And you see it today in Gaza. With the amount of destruction, there's still a will to live. I'll quote Mahmoud Darwish, "Ala hadi al-ard ma yastahiq al-haya." On this land, there is something that is deserving of life. And I think that's our perspective, that's our unique perspective of resilience, of bouncing back up every time, which gives us maybe a different perspective, maybe a different way of looking at things. Maybe.
And if I could add to that, the sense that something that I notice, you know, living in a place like the UK, is that there's always shock that something has happened. How could it possibly be? How could people act in this way? But perhaps we've always known people can act in this way, and we have always known that people can act differently, right? And I think there's something in knowing that there is always... I mean, when you said the thought that came to mind is my aunt is still in Khartoum, and you know, she's had a tank in front of her house for years now, and yet she, you know, when she does get internet to call me on WhatsApp, she is very happy to tell me off. She does it like it's not like, oh, the war is really bad. It's like, why haven't you called me? And you know, and also, why don't you do XYZ, and have you had a child yet? And you know, like, it's very just auntie behavior. And there's something in that for me that I don't know, I just find like, she's not she's like, I don't want to hear your questions about the war, like, send me photos of flowers, like, that's you know, she will send me, she's been looking after, she's grown lemon trees in her front garden. And that's what she wants to tell me about.
Beautiful. I've been a very crap chair, but I hope you won't be cross with me because we've got 10 minutes left, just about, for questions. So questions and comments from the audience. I know what we've heard today has been very moving. It's probably going to affect a lot of people. So I can understand if, you know, you're feeling, you're absorbing what's going on. But any questions and comments, and also from our online audience? So we'll take a couple. So the lady at the back there with the glasses.
Hi, my name is Poppy, and the reason I'm standing up is because I was sat by the kind lady with a red T-shirt right behind this contraption. I want to make a comment and tell a little story, since that's what we're doing. The comment is that I've come to the view from hearing our speakers about story being a means to an end rather than an end in itself. We come together as a community, we come to certain realizations, and then what, right? So I think the and then what is sort of haunting this room. So here's my little story from Monday. So I got arrested on Monday for sitting outside the Royal Courts of Justice with a placard saying, I oppose terrorism. Saving lives is not terrorism. I support Palestine Action. And I was arrested by three policemen, and there were five of them in the van taking me down to Peckham Police Station. And this is the interesting thing. The entire time, through the entire journey, the police talked about books. Books, right? And although I was non-compliant initially, after they carried me off from the place of sitting, I stopped pissing them off. And I sort of wanted to endear myself to them and get to them and see and instruct them about what they should read and what they should do in the event that they're sent off at 3 o'clock in the morning to knock on the door of a political dissident, like, you know, police do in police states. And I think I got to one or two of them. And I would like to urge everybody here to, as a consequence, to tell our new Prime Minister when he gets into power that what he should do is repeal the Terrorism Act.
Gentleman there in the black T-shirt.
An effective use of story, if I ever heard one.
And then the lady in the blue.
What's interesting about one of the scenes in The Clamour is how all the women treat the puppet like a living entity. And I come from a community where we discuss whether there is a fine line between reality and illusion. How do you both navigate those two human experiences when creating stories?
Nice question, thank you. And then there's a lady here in the front.
Yes, hello. Question for Nizar. You've told us about your project next year. What about the one that you're doing right now? Return of the Buffalo, and what is it that you hope to achieve through it? What kind of activism and outcomes do you hope to achieve? Thank you.
I'll start with that, and then I'll talk about illusion and reality. I was asked by a very, very good theater in New York and very close friends of mine, what is my reaction to the 250th that America is celebrating? And the first instinct was, what 250? This land has people in it for millennia, and they are the true owners of the land, being from a complicated place. And I suggested that we ram a herd of buffalo, and that's what we're doing. We're working with the Lakota and the Lenape tribes, and we are going to run a herd of buffalo through New York City in September, working again with multiple communities, with a lot of artists, with a lot of very good storytellers to tell the story, to tell a very different story of America that isn't so true. And I think buffalo are gorgeous because they are a moment of pure reckoning, right? For you that don't know about American history, maybe I'm sure this room knows more than me, but they were driven to extinction. There were almost 20 million in the America on the plains, but they were driven to extinction to a few hundreds, and they were killed in order to starve the First Nations. So man-made starvation, something that is not
familiar to the British.
And familiar to the British, of course. And that man-made starvation was a way to ethnically cleanse the First Nations. Both attempts failed. The Lakota are proud and exist and have stories and spiritual practices. And the Bison are making a huge comeback and taking over new territories. And one of the most beautiful things about this is that for the Lakota spiritual world, the return of the Bison is also a reset of time. So by bringing a big herd of bison into America, I hope we reset time. And the first thing that I hope the new time has is no orange men and a bit more compassion. That's buffalo. And in a way, that also answers your question. I think storytelling is where we stitch reality and fiction, where we stitch reality and imagination. It could be deep spiritual beliefs like people flying off mountains carried by angels, which is real, or more fantastical beings like dragons. But I think they're all the way we stitch the reality. Again, like I told you, I'm a father. The joy of telling your children a story that slowly, slowly seeps from reality and that's the best stories. So I don't see I don't know where the difference is. It's all delusional after a while.
Wonderful.
Yeah, maybe, yeah, just to pick up on that, when you asked that question, I thought, I spend a lot of time wondering how much of our reality is an illusion, right? Like, which is an odd thing maybe for someone trained as an engineer to say. I think, in engineering, we're very much told there is, the world of STEM prides itself on things that are true and provable and whatever, and then you get like quantum, and then you get kind of, the deeper you go, the less sure, the less uncertain. And that to me is fascinating. And I guess maybe as a person of faith, I think that kind of fits, God, we don't even know why yawning is contagious. Like, do we think we know anything about this world? I don't know. So yeah.
Brilliant answer. We've got time for one or two more questions. Anything online, or are we okay online? So, okay, lady in the front here, and then the gentleman in the white shirt.
Hello. Oh, I have a question for you, because I'm aware that puppeteering is quite an intricate thing to do in making it seem real, so I'm sure you had great people doing that. But while managing it, and you said sometimes you wanted to express more sadness or happiness or like the feelings of a 10-year-old, and as a director you might not want to expose that magic, but did you have like specific signs that you would follow? Do you had, because there's several people puppeteering this girl, or would everyone kind of just listen to each other and feel in the moment? Was there a way of I guess you couldn't decide that beforehand. How should we
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. And the gentleman in back in the short sleeve white shirt.
Thank you. My question is for Yasmin. Amir Nizar was talking a lot about community in his artistic practice. And I think a lot of the conversation around writers is that it's quite a solitary act. But I was just wondering your perspective on writing and sort of the artistic craft of your writing as a community act, and sort of how you think about that difference and in that part of the storytelling that you do.
Thank you both.
It's very simple, actually. It is about a group of people listening to each other and agreeing. And we practice, we rehearse, we try and understand them as words, as sequences. And after you know enough words, you can think. And slowly, slowly, gorillas start thinking, or 10-year-old, very sophisticated pieces of furniture, because that's at the end what puppets are. They're not real. creatures. But what brings life into them is an agreement of a group of people that listen constantly to each other and agree or disagree. It doesn't really matter as long as they're together trying to create a moment. And that I think that's what's beautiful about them. And because we're in the streets, it's never set. It's always a bit of a negotiation. And working a lot with the team, we keep on saying there's a long story, yes, no negotiation that goes on and on and on and on, like in real life. But in three, when you're doing this puppet, and in four, when you're doing an elephant, and in one, when you're doing, in two, when you're doing one puppet vervet, because there's you and there's the puppet itself that is also autonomous and decides things.
Thanks for the question, and I'm going to embarrass you slightly. Corey and I worked together on Youth Without Borders, which is something that, shockingly, I was just calculating was almost 20 years ago, an organization I founded as a teenager. And I really like the question because, for me, I maybe am not a pure writer. You know, I don't think of myself as like a pure writer or a pure artist because I don't write for the sake of writing, right? Like when people say, oh, all I care about is like the beauty of the line, I don't actually only care about the beauty of the line. For me, what is the line doing? You know, like, that's maybe why I've always been somebody who's put my writing out in the world, because I want people to engage with the ideas. I want people to feel and to think, and then we do something about it. You know, to answer your question, like, what next? The what next is sometimes informed by what is written. The what next is sometimes informed by people's reactions to what is written, and then you move on from there. I could not bear just writing and then putting it in my cupboard or putting it in my drawer. Like, Emily Dickinson, like, great, I'm glad you wrote poetry and then people discovered it after you died, RIP. But, like, that would be such a sad experience for me because it's like just, I can't. And so, you know, maybe part of it is like writing is inextricable from, and storytelling is inextricable from activism, from advocacy. I think about the way that I learned, my politics came from organizing first, and then it came from reading, and then it came from words that were put down by people generations before me, and I had a conversation with that, and that allowed me to have a conversation with other people. And so when I think about what I write, I think maybe there's two things that I think about. One is like, is the point of this story, like, can this story just live beyond me? Like, is this a story that, especially when it comes to publishing books, I think there's a question of like, perhaps maybe what I want to say is that in the commercial world, the thing that is important to people is sales, right? Like, how many books have you sold? Is it on the bestseller list? Like, that's the thing that people talk about. That's how you judge what success is. But for me, it's actually like, will this text be passed from one person to the next? Will people read it and talk about it? And will it maybe change their mind about something? Or will it sit in the back of their head for like 15 years, and then when the right moment comes, it germinates? Like, that for me is what I'm hoping to do. And yeah, maybe that, you know, maybe I'm less of a literary person because of it, but frankly, I don't really care.
No, that book.
Oh.
Bloody good.
Thank you.
I took 20 years to write a novel. So what I'm saying is just don't give up, but read this book. It is so fast-moving, fast-paced, and really inspiring. Total respect. We have, unfortunately, run out of time. But I want to thank on your behalf our wonderful speakers who have spoken so honestly about difficult, really painful human suffering, issues that are ongoing, scars that are not healing, and come from places where these are epicentres of human suffering. So we really appreciate it, and we won't forget today.
We're epicentres of human knowledge before we're epicentres of human suffering. It's important to remember that. Both our countries sit on mountains of knowledge.
And also, just FYI, Sudan has more pyramids than Egypt. I don't know if you know this. Every Sudanese person has to tell you this within 15 minutes of them meeting you. They have better PR, but ours are better. Sizes and everything. Okay. Yeah, anyway.
Wonderful, Yasmin. Thank you so, so much. Thank you to everybody in the room for turning up and everybody online. Thank you both.
story.
And also I want to thank Louise, because this is very much her baby, and she had a vision for this event. And thank you also to everybody who's helped run this event and helped with the tech. So thank you, Louise, and your team.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.